No, like, so I think you raise an interesting point because I feel like when you have experience going somewhere else and being in a different culture where you go through a couple of experiences of being shocked by something and then realizing that, oh, like that's what people do here. It makes you more open to different ideas or different
Right, to suspend judgment immediately, I guess. Right, or for a period. Yeah, that definitely does it for sure.
And I mean, ultimately, like eating another human being is is like a really extreme example of it.
Hello there, Micah here, Kyotopia Podcast, back in the saddle again. Where are we headed? Well, as the title suggests, we are going to talk a little bit about social norms and cultural relativism. I am joined by Henty Lim, who is the author of Something Like Hope, a collection of short stories that all take place in Tokyo. We talk about his experience living in Tokyo as an author and freelance translator. He shares with us some insights and tips for those of you who just long to be good enough at Japanese to read a book. I know that's a very big milestone for a lot of us. We also talk about his many influences, specifically Murata Sayaka, who is known for her short stories which often explore taboo themes. They often challenge what it means to be normal. And at the bottom of the episode, we are going to hear a reading of one of his translations of Murata Sayaka. It's a story called Pochi, which is about a somewhat unusual pet. So, without further ado, this is The New Normal. I was recently posed with the question, "What is culture?" by a student recently. And it kind of annoyed me. There is a part of me that both loves and loathes these sort of questions. What is art? What is morality? What does it mean to live the good life? When I was in high school, I was first exposed to philosophy, and I always found it very interesting to explore these ideas and words we so often use in conversation, despite them being so difficult to define. The topic of culture comes up a lot when you live as an expat in Japan. Being from the West, you can't avoid standing out, and people genuinely want to know what you like about Japan, and what your opinion is about some of the more obvious cultural differences. It should be no surprise, though. It's often the differences that strike us as the most interesting and worthy topic of conversation. The longer you stay, you may begin to notice a transformation beginning to occur from within you. I'm not suggesting that if you live in Japan, you will power up and become a Super Saiyan. No, what I mean is, you may start to realize that what you once felt to be familiar and acceptable behavior has shifted a little. Things that were odd or awkward start to feel normal and even preferred. A crude yet simple example would be, if you no longer find the slurping of noodles annoying, and if you find yourself feeling more awkward not slurping down your bowl of ramen, well, by golly, you've gone native. And now, tips for eating ramen with Teiichi Sakurai.
Hi, my name is Teiichi Sakurai. I'm at the ramen shop. Today, I'm going to show you how to eat the ramen. Here we go. You know, noodles are usually jumping around, but don't worry about it. That's very casual. People do this. You know, do this and eat. That's okay. You know, ramen is a very open format. You can eat any way you want to. But one thing I want you to avoid is just taking too much time. The ramen noodle actually is going to expand or overflow to the bowl. So eat quick as much as you can.
Thanks, Teiichi. And now back to the Kyotopia Podcast with Micah. Have you ever heard of the term reverse culture shock? This is when you go home after living abroad for several years and you start to notice little things that once felt normal suddenly seem strange. And the fact that you should find them normal, but don't, makes this feeling all the stranger. For me, this would include things like wearing shoes inside someone's house, especially when they have carpet. Tipping culture as well, I don't think I'll ever be able to get used to that again. Or just the overwhelming space and emptiness of the American suburbs. On the other side of the world, I have become accustomed to a lot of different things I never suspected I would get used to. For one, I deeply enjoy Japanese bath culture. I am of course referring to the public baths, or sento, as well as the hot springs, or onsen. Getting naked and sharing a bath with a stranger, or even a friend, no longer feels entirely awkward to me. The first moment I realized I had maybe disregarded the significance of this cultural difference happened when I sent a copy of Studio Ghibli's Tonari no Totoro, or My Neighbor Totoro, to my sister's family for Christmas, along with a small Totoro stuffed doll for my niece, who was about 2 or 3 years old at the time. My intention was innocent enough. I wanted to share a little bit of Japanese culture with my family, in particular something that might appeal to my 3-year-old niece. But there was one scene that I had completely forgotten about.
Yeah, I do remember that.
You remember Totoro?
Okay, well, and this is watching it from a parent perspective with a small kid. So mm-hmm. It's maybe different than as an adult perspective, but she was only 2. Now we would probably have a discussion. I would have asked you, I'm sure, like, is this a normal thing? I think we probably glossed over it at the time and stopped watching it because she was only 2. But now I would definitely talk to her about it, you know, or I would have asked you just, hey, is this a normal thing in Japan? Mm-hmm. Just curious because she's wondering. I think the family all slept together. They bathed together and they showed, you know, like the butts and stuff going into the bathroom and everything. So that was a little different. I think it seems strange because we were brought up having modesty or not. I think it's a father and daughter, maybe, is what I'm thinking from the movie. So that, I think growing up, I mean, I don't ever remember seeing our dad naked or, you know, if he was changing, he was in another room. So that was something that I just, you know, that I was never a part of that when we were young. So I think, you know, maybe they were separate genders, a little more like, okay, well, maybe they don't have modesty around being nude in front of each other, you know, even if they're male and female. So.
なるほど.
Kyotopia's own Yuko-sensei provides us with a Japanese perspective.
When I watched the Totoro first time, it was long time ago. I think I remember that they are taking bus together, right? Mm-hmm. Oto-san and Mei-chan. Satsuki-chan definitely more than the 6 or 7 years old. どうかな? I'm just trying to remember my childhood. I think I was taking bath or taking shower with my dad when I was maybe, how do you say, 小学校低学年.
That's the first 3 years of elementary school.
Something like that. But when I was like 5th grade or 6th grade, I already kind of refusing not taking bath with him mm-hmm. because I felt uncomfortable or 恥ずかしい mm-hmm. feeling. Mm-hmm. But usually family people don't mind to be naked or like be seen. Usually people don't mind, I think. I think with friends, it's totally normal. You know, just we just hang out or sometimes we go to sento, public bus together, and it doesn't matter any age. So like usually people don't mind taking, if you're a close friend, just go or for example, travel together. And then we love to take onsen or sento at the hotel together. If you are close friends, it's totally fine to be naked and then have bath together. I don't feel embarrassed or uncomfortable. Male and female, just friends, mm-hmm. and then having bath together, that's okay. It's impossible. I mean, it's not, I mean, maybe like osana najimi, they've been very, very close friends since they were a child or like since they were a baby. Maybe yes, but male and female friend, even if we are very close, but still, we don't do that.
So I was inspired to talk about culture and what we consider socially acceptable for this episode after a conversation I had with Hinti Lim.
Hello.
As I mentioned before, Hinti is an author.
Originally from Adelaide, Australia.
Having lived in Japan for well over a decade.
Started off in Nagasaki and then moved to Tokyo. I've done a number of different things. I worked in teaching for a while, for a long time. Moved into marketing, and now I work as a full-time translator.
Translating mostly light novels and manga into English. As a fellow creator and avid reader, Hinti pushed me to making the leap into Japanese literature when he introduced me to the works of Murata Sayaka. Murata Sayaka is a Japanese writer who was born in 1979. She has won many prestigious awards in literature in Japan, the Gunzo Prize for New Writers, the Mishima Yukio Prize, the Noma Literary New Face Prize, and the Akutagawa Prize. Her most well-known work is titled Konbini Ningen, or Convenience Store Woman. It sold over 1.5 million copies in Japan and became her first to be translated into English. Hinti recommended that I try moving on from manga to short stories. This is when he recommended a collection by Murata Sayaka. The first story in the collection goes by the title Seimeishiki, a story where we are thrown into a world in which it has become normal for funerals to be followed by a custom where the meat of the dead friend or relative is prepared into a nabe, or hot pot, and shared among the family and attendees. After consuming the meat of the deceased, it is often customary, though not required, to find another person and, quote-unquote, mate with them. Through its characters and the situations that occur, the author does a surprisingly convincing job showing us the meaning behind this practice.
Murata Sayaka uses she uses different words that kind of make it sound a little more clean, like what everyone's
right.
doing. Like mm-hmm. she doesn't just call it sex anymore. It's like it
right.
has like a kind of
juice
creation kind of feel to it,
yeah.
right?
Mm-hmm.
Because like as humans, we kind of sometimes need that to bypass certain logic or like morals or whatever else it might be. When you have experience going somewhere else and being in a different culture where you go through a couple of experiences of being shocked by something and then realizing that, oh, like that's what people do here. It makes you more open to different ideas. And I mean, ultimately, like eating another human being is like a really extreme example of it. But the story sets it up straight away into it being like something that's just very normal for everyone except for the main character, who at the same time is kind of struggling with the idea. You know, she's not completely against it, but she's like, wait, is this supposed to be the right thing? Like,
and then she starts to do what we as a reader are supposed to do and be like, what does it mean to be normal?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I really like, I think this is probably the main message, maybe, if you could say that there is one, is a quote that she's talking. I think it was, maybe it was the guy that she sees on the beach says that like, there's all different kinds of truth, right? And social norms are the most gray, flexible kind of truth. And using the metaphor analogy of like gradation and how people and culture shifts and changes. And we're just in this little sliver of a color right now.
Mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. When I read that story and pretty much all the stories through that short story collection tend to be about questioning the idea of normal. And I think I haven't read all of Murata's work, but I feel like it's kind of it's a theme that she explores a lot.
Mm-hmm.
This idea of like, let's take what is normal and explore whether it is or it isn't, right? And if normal was something different, what would it be? That idea, that theme runs through all the stories in really interesting ways.
These sort of strange, dark, speculative realities are what people have come to expect from Murata Sayaka's work. Her writing often challenges what we in society consider to be normal. In fact, a lot of her characters include those that question and resist social conformity, particularly when it comes to gender roles, parenthood, and sex. All this aside, thanks to Hinti, I have finally dipped my toes into the waters of Japanese literature. And it's fun. I feel reinvigorated and excited about going deeper and learning more and improving my reading ability. As a writer himself and translator, and someone who consumes lots of Japanese literature, I asked him for some advice for those of you who are studying and just want to be able to read a book in Japanese.
When it comes to books, I usually recommend for people to start at a really low level. Read something that you don't have to look up in a dictionary constantly. I mean, when you first start out, it's just there's like a kind of wall that you have to break through in terms of being able to read something quite freely. I think as a starting point, actually, like, kids' books tend to be really great. When I was working in an elementary school, I would sometimes read what some of the kids were reading in some of the classes that I was reading, because at the time, like, we're talking like 6-7 years ago, my reading level wasn't really very great. And I remember picking up a book that I think it was like a fourth or a fifth grader was reading, and leafing through it and being like, wow, I can understand this without putting like huge amounts of effort into it. You know, like, I don't have to take out my dictionary all the time. And so that experience was really eye-opening for me. So I tend to tell people, if it's not too embarrassing for you, start with something that's for kids and work your way up to the sorts of things that I translate now, which is like light novels. Light novels tend to be written in a way where a lot of the language is really consistent throughout. And so you're getting really good access to very common literary forms and words that are used in literature that aren't necessarily used in speech. But it's not so difficult that you feel like you're putting together a puzzle while you're trying to read a book at the same time. I give that as advice for people, but like at the same time, when I was doing those sorts of things, when I was reading kids' books and when I was reading light novels, I was still going to the bookshop and I was picking up books by Ogawa Yoko and Murakami Haruki, and I was still trying to read those books. Mm-hmm. because as a writer, I had that pride,
right,
where I was like, this is the stuff that I want to read, you know, for mm-hmm. better or for worse. And so I had that kind of stuff that I was still reading, but it just tends to be very like, it tends to be so much slower than when you read in your first language. So there's like a patience that you need for that, I think.
All right. So now that I have him here, I really wanted to ask Hinti about his book called Something Like Hope, which I picked up back in 2018 and I wasn't able to put down until I finished. Something Like Hope is a
collection of short stories that have been drawn from a huge collection of different writings that I've put on the website medium.com from, I think, like late 2015, maybe 2016 was when I started posting there. So it was a mixture of, what would you call it? Like fictional autobiographical stories was where it started, where like I took things that I was experiencing at the time and then gave them a fictional twist. And then as I started getting more confident with that, I started branching into like complete fiction outside of anything autobiographical. And so Something Like Hope is it's a collection of short stories that all broadly fit the theme of the stories in Tokyo that may or may not be hidden. Basically the sorts of stories that you pass by if you live in the city that might happen to the people that you ride the train with, or the people that you pass by at Shibuya Crossing, or the people who are at the table next to you in an izakaya, or the people who are sitting at the end of a bar somewhere that you visit, you know, late in the evening, or perhaps even the people who are eating a bowl of ramen at the end of a late evening, or the early morning for that matter. So it's kind of all stories about what I like to imagine can sometimes happen in the parts of the city that you don't see, right? There are parts of Tokyo that I've seen only in passing, right? Sometimes you'll walk down an alleyway and it'll just be filled with bars, right? You'll see the signs for bars and hostess clubs, host clubs that go up all the way, right? It's like from the first floor all the way up to the eighth, and there's just all of these bars right down the street. And so oftentimes when I would walk through those alleyways, I would think about like, I wonder what sort of people go to those sorts of bars. I wonder what sort of people work in those sorts of bars. I wonder what life is like if you frequent a place like that, or if you live around an area like that. That kind of thing was oftentimes where stories would come from, along with news reports or, yeah, that kind of thing, media.
The second story, Cigarettes in the Dark, which is a story about a man who jumps off of a train platform because he's accused of like molesting someone. He's accused of touching someone inappropriately mm-hmm. on a busy platform.
He is, of course, referring to chikang, which is the Japanese term for groping, often in the crowded trains.
He runs off the train station into a tunnel and he meets a girl who's just smoking cigarettes. Mm-hmm. That story came from something that happened. Like a middle-aged businessman was actually accused of touching someone on a train station platform, after which he leapt off the platform, ran down the train tracks, and then jumped over a fence to get away from it. The idea of like someone doing that was so unbelievable to me at the time, even after seeing the long shot video of a guy running across like the gravel and trying to scramble over this fence. The idea of someone taking that kind of drastic measure and running down the train tracks was so like, I couldn't get it out of my mind for a couple mm-hmm. of days. And I felt compelled to write something around that idea. I just made up a personality for a guy who may or may not be innocent. And just, I just let my imagination kind of run wild with the sort of person he might be.
The book itself is very compact. It seemed to me that it was mimicking the traditional Japanese paperback format, which is 105 by 148 millimeters, to be exact. I asked him if this was intentional.
Bunkobon size, as it's called in Japanese. So, I mean, it's just basically, it just means paperback. That's the standard paperback size for books in Japan. And the reason I decided to make it that size was simply because the very first time I came to Japan, this is going way back when I was in university and I visited for, I think it was just 2 weeks. I went into a bookstore looking for manga, for comics. And I walked in and I saw the paperbacks and just the size of them and the price of them. They were so much cheaper than, they were probably like half the price of what a paperback cost in Australia at the time. And I was just so charmed that there were all these books that were so cheap and in a size that was easy to fit in a pocket. And I remember thinking like, man, I wish I could read these. Like I wish I could enjoy these because they're cheap and I could buy so many of them and I could keep them on a shelf without them being too big. I kind of decided if I ever publish a book at some point, like I want it to be that size. Like I want, ideally, and this is getting like a bit I guess like romantic in terms of the idea, but like I wanted to potentially give to a reader that same feeling. Like I wanted them to have this little book and be like, oh wow, I can fit this in my pocket, or like this is so easy to take with me and not be too expensive. Like I wanted to give someone that same sense of for lack of a better word, like wonder that I felt at the time.
And Mr. Lim has been gracious enough to offer up that sense of wonder to you, our beloved listeners. He has sent me a limited amount of copies of Something Like Hope, exclusively for our patrons. So if you subscribe to our Patreon, patreon.com/kyotopia, we will be sending you a copy for free. Thanks, Senti. And for everyone else, I highly recommend you check it out. You can order a copy from the website snippetsbooks.com. Please see the link in the description of this episode. And now, for your listening pleasure, Mr. Lim will be reading his translation of Murata Sayaka's short story, Pochi. Potential trigger warning. Some may find the content of this story disturbing or offensive. So yeah, please be advised. This is Pochi.
Can you do the feeding for me today? Yuki asked. Sure, I nodded. Thanks, said Yuki, relieved. I'll be there as soon as I'm done. Yuki was diligent, and she was busy handling class duties today. She'd never once skipped a feeding. I'd asked her to cover for me for all sorts of reasons, like piano practice or helping out my mom. I was happy that she was asking me for a change. At the end of the day, I ran to the mountain behind the school grounds. Yuki and I kept a secret pet in a small hut there. I had 3 bread rolls in my bag, all of them leftovers from school lunch. Pochi was waiting for me quietly. Hey there, Pochi. You hungry? I asked. Pochi turned to me slowly. He stared intently at the bread in my hands through his broken glasses. I don't know where Pochi came from. One day, Yuki just brought him up. "Hey, Mizuho," she said. "I'm keeping a pet in the mountains. You want to come see him?" My heart leapt. Yuki was quiet, and she didn't talk about herself very much. She was different from the other kids in class. She had a world of her own, and she just calmly watched the rest of us, the teachers, me, the other students. I adored her. Yuki sharing a secret with me was such a sweet, pleasant joy. But when she showed me the middle-aged man at the small hut in the mountain, I couldn't believe what I was seeing. I didn't let it show, but the man was about the same age as my father. "This is Pochi," Yuki said, matter-of-factly. "Yuki, this is your pet?" I asked. "Yep. Don't you think he's adorable?" I watched Yuki rub the middle-aged man's head as he stared at the ground. It terrified me. "Don't you think he should have a collar?" I asked. This was my immediate response. I thought it best to keep the pet from doing us any harm in case it was dangerous. Yuki listened to my suggestion and nodded in agreement. "You're right. He is a pet, isn't he? Oh, I'm so glad you're here, Mizuho. I never would have thought of that." The next time I saw Pochi, he had a red collar. The collar wasn't connected to a chain, so it struck me as pointless. But Yuki was so happy that I couldn't bring myself to say anything. "I went with red," said Yuki. "It's just like your favorite dress, don't you think?" "My dress?" I asked. "Yes, because Pochi is our pet." Yuki smiled then, and it was such a rare sight that the word dangerous simply vanished from my mind. Yuki had put my favorite color on her most precious pet. I was so happy that my cheeks flushed red. "Thanks, Yuki," I said. "The collar is really cute. It's such a nice fit." I timidly approached Pochi and gave him a pat. He smelled like a wild animal, and the pale skin on the top of his head was sticky and wet. Just as Pochi was finishing the bread I gave him, there was a knock at the door. "Mizuho, are you there?" Yuki was at the door with her school bag on. I could tell she'd come as soon as she finished up at school. "Here, Pochi," she said. "I brought you some milk." Pochi looked happy, but also a little apprehensive. He stared at the bottle Yuki took from her bag. "Come on now. This is for you, Pochi. Drink up." Yuki poured the milk into Pochi's bowl, and he happily started drinking it. "Pochi's got quite the appetite today," I said as Yuki rubbed his head. "He ate 3 bread rolls before you got here." "Wow, you must have been hungry, huh?" I was reluctant to pat Pochi. There were things about him that were cute and adorable, but touching him still creeped me out a little. It didn't seem to bother Yuki, who went on rubbing Pochi's head and the stubble of his beard. Yuki and I met an hour before school started and went to the mountain. We didn't lock Pochi in his hut, but he never ran away. He just waited there, quiet and still, until we came to visit. He always crawled around on his hands and knees and didn't use his hands except for when he was eating. I found that something of a relief. Yuki and I always held hands when we opened the door to Pochi's hidden hut. He'd be there on all fours, looking at us with dewy eyes. He hardly ever barked, but very occasionally you'd hear him speak.
"Get it done by 2,
he'd growl. It was like an order he might have given to someone before he was our pet. I once asked Yuki where she found Pochi. "Otemachi," she said. "I had a cram school test, so I went by myself. I found him there, all lost and confused. I took him home, fed him, and really liked him. That was when you popped into my mind, Mizuho. I just knew it would be fun if we looked after him together." There might have been people in Otemachi who were looking for Pochi, but Yuki and I decided that if his owners came looking, we'd keep him totally secret. He was really attached to us, and there was no doubt that he preferred life in the mountain behind the school more so than he did life in Otemachi. One day, we went to feed Pochi and the door to his hut was open.
Pochi, Yuki called, dashing inside. We found big shoe prints, but there was no sign of our pet. Pochi! Pochi! I peered down at the footprints. Do you think these came from Otemachi? I asked. But it can't be, said Yuki. Did Pochi go back? Yuki was pale. Her shoulders drooped. I reached out to hug her, but then we heard something. Pochi! Yuki slipped out of my grasp and ran outside, where Pochi was crouched on the ground. Oh, Pochi! I'm so relieved! Yuki wrapped him in a hug and rubbed his head. It looked like he'd been running away from his Otemachi pursuers. His head and his suit were all covered with leaves.
Get it done by two.
Pochi's voice was low and quiet, and he closed his eyes as Yuki held him.
That is it for today's episode, everyone. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you to our patrons for always supporting us. For those of you who may be interested, I will be uploading the Japanese reading of this story to the Patreon website. So if you're a patron, you'll be able to hear that. You can find that at patreon.com/kyotopia. それではまた次回。さよなら。Day off and keep